My name is Dan, and I am weird. But I don't see weird as a bad thing, though. Being weird just means you march to the beat of a different drum. You don't fit that mold that society wants to shove you into. I'm out searching for people like me. The weirder, the better. This is my story. These are their stories. This is the power of weird. This episode of The Power of Weird is brought to you by the Rosemary Run novel series, published by Standards of Starlight Books. Follow the women of Rosemary Run, California, as they face the darkness hiding beneath their community's picturesque facade. The stakes are high, and the twists and turns will keep you on the edge of your seat when you read these emotional, pulse-pounding, domestic suspense novels with characters who always show up for each other when it counts. Find out more about the Rosemary Run series, as well as other Standards of Starlight novels at standardsofstarlight.com or by following the link in the description below. Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Power of Weird. My name is Dan, and I'm your host. A little bit about me. I'm 37 years old. I'm 6'7" tall. In my adult life, I've weighed as little as 295 pounds and as much as 640 pounds. I'm sometimes too smart for my own good, but at times in personal relationships, I'm also pretty clueless. I've been a vegetarian since 2001, and I also don't drink coffee. I'm a sought-after brand designer and leadership coach and the co-founder of a lightsaber combat program. I'm also a dad to a great 17-year-old kid and a proud uncle to three nephews, 21, 18, and 9, and three nieces, 15, 14, and 12. What's probably more interesting about me, though, is that I'm an autistic entrepreneur and business professional. A book that I read in my early 20s changed my life forever. It was called The Secret of the Shadow by an author named Debbie Ford. In this book, Debbie talks about the things that we sometimes are embarrassed about ourselves, bringing them into the light and making them work for you. Creating your own special recipe with the ingredients that only you have to make a difference in your life and in the world. At this point in my life, I already knew I was weird, but I didn't know about my diagnosis. I've tried to accomplish the mission she set out for me in this book every day since. I'll leave a link to the book in this description below. Part of that mission was to make this podcast, finding other people who are weird or different or who don't fit in and who are living their best lives because of it. Through interviewing them and telling their stories, I hope to learn more about myself and that everyone listening does the same. Today I sit down with Army veteran, father of three, tech guru, and professional photographer James Kling. James knew he had met the one for him in high school when his girlfriend at the time, his now wife, agreed that their firstborn son would be named James Tiberius after the notorious captain of Star Trek's USS Enterprise. You can find out more about James in the description below. Hey there, everybody, and welcome to this episode of The Power of Weird. This guest that I have today needs no introduction. How you doing, man?
We're here.
Fair enough. So moving and all that kind of stuff, it's got to be crazy, man. I mean, you still don't have everything with you guys, right?
We do not. We've got another one, maybe two trips to make the drive to Portland. I think we might just pay somebody to come do it for us.
Fair enough.
We'll see.
That's not a bad way to go. For those of you folks out there, I will give a little introduction. This is an old friend of mine. His name is James Kling, or as we call him, Jim, like Jim Kirk from Star Trek, of course. He is a great guy, and he just moved from Portland, Oregon area, right? Yeah? No, yep. Portland. Yep, yeah, right, in Portland. I can never remember whether you were across the state line.
We did. We lived in the Washington side of the Columbia River.
Right, okay. Yeah. So just moved from Portland to Indiana. So it's not like you're just going a short little ways. Like when you say you got two trips, that's two big trips.
Yeah, about 2,000 miles. So
I'm going to jump right into this. The whole Power of Weird thing, as everybody who listens knows, it's all about people who are unique and different. And, you know, we talk about all sorts of different things about, you know, entrepreneurship and, you know, fandoms, all this different kind of stuff, anything that really sets people apart. And, you know, you're one of those people like me, like you were like geeky and nerdy and weird before it was cool, you know, like back in the day. And the epitome of like how people can know that, you have evidence in your kids, if I remember correctly.
Oh, yeah. Is that right? Oh, absolutely. So yeah, I've got three children and they're all named after starship captains. So yeah. I got Captain Kirk, Captain Pike, and Captain Janeway. So yeah.
Which is absolutely awesome.
We were weird before it was cool. It's true. And it's like I'm a little offended, all these people thinking, you know, weird is cool. But you know, so I did end up moving to Portland where they embrace the weird well.
They
so
really
it's good.
Do.
Really do.
Yeah, yeah, that's that works, man. And so just to date the whole, we were weird before it was cool. How old is your oldest?
The oldest is 19. I got twins, they're 19, and the youngest is 15.
Okay, yeah. So again, 19 years ago, this man looked at his wife, who is a lovely lady, and said, "My children need to have Starship Captain names." And what's amazing is she said, "Okay." But yeah,
that was how I knew I could marry her. I told her what we were dating. It's like, look, my firstborn son is going to be named James Tiberius. Are you cool with that? And when she said, "Yeah, I'm good with that," that was, I knew, all right, I can propose.
Well, the question was, is did she know what she was getting into at that point? Did she realize why, like what the significance of that was?
I'm willing to bet that I don't think she cared, because her family is crazier than mine.
Oh, wow.
So it's all good.
Dang. That's something, man.
Oh yeah.
Whew. That is, yeah. I know this guy very well, everybody out there. So him saying that her family's crazier than his is saying something.
It really is.
Yeah.
I think she will admit that too. Although her side usually involves more psychiatric institutions.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Well, you know, and Christy is a lovely human being. I mean, she is just regular and like, you know, intelligent.
Yeah.
And
we don't know what we can do to make her a little bit more weird, but
yeah,
we'll try.
Man. I mean, like, she is just a, like, you wouldn't think that she comes from that kind of background, because she is just a nice, regular person.
I think that is her weirdness, though. She grew up with so much dysfunction that her becoming out normal, that's the weirdness.
Fair enough, man. I can dig that.
That's like, what do you call that? There's a word for that.
Irony would be the word.
Malicious compliance.
Oh.
Malicious compliance. That's what I was looking for. Malicious compliance.
Okay. I like it. Yeah. The word coming to my mind was irony, but you know,
she's like the daughter in the Monsters.
Right.
Or was it the cousin? I don't remember.
That's something. One of them. Yeah, but I'm not
the pretty blonde girl on the Monsters.
Right.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Her being normal is her weirdness.
Right. No, I dig it, man. That's very cool. So I'm hearing in the background some little chirpity chirp sounds. I figured people would want to know what that was, so they didn't think they were having a stroke or something while they're listening.
I'm trying to keep them at bay, but they are obnoxiously loud today. I do have parakeets. We've got 8 of them in the house. 6 of them here in my office. This is their room. We have the breeding pair that are their parents. Those belong to my son. Those were his high school pet, and we still have them while he's in school. But I got 6 of them. 3 of them are from one brood and 3 from another. The first brood was Mike, Sully, and Boo. Mike is the green one. He's the big round green one. The big blue one is Sully, and the little yellow one was Boo.
I like it. Very cool.
And then the newest 3 are Homestar, Marzipan, and Strong Bad from the old Homestar Runner web series.
Oh man, I love it. See, that's cool. Well, one of the reasons I bring it up too is it's cool to have some kind of ambient sound. I just didn't want anybody listening, like say on their way to or from work, to think a bird had gotten into the car. You know, I remember listening to a show on NPR at one point many years ago, and they had like an ambulance sound or something like that.
Oh, I hate that.
Oh man, it was rough. And I was looking all around, and like it took me a minute to register that it was, you know,
on the TV. I think that should be something in audio on radio, that if there's ever a siren, they have to have an announcement. Hey, by the way, there's a siren here. It's not around you.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Sort of disclaimer when that comes on, just so people aren't, because that's going to cause accidents, man.
Yeah. Exactly. Right.
Be rubbernecking, looking for the ambulance. Smacking the car in front of them.
Fortunately, I was like in my neighborhood at the time, so I wasn't going very fast, but like I was looking all around. I was like, do I need to pull over? Like, you know, what's happening? Oh, it's insane. So yeah. One thing I want to throw out there is you do professionally some stuff that I just find fascinating in the worlds of like coding and technology and different things like that. I've always been a front end guy as far as tech goes, but I'm well on the record and documented as saying, like, if I sat down to code something and did it for 3 weeks straight or whatever the case may be, and then when it was all done, it didn't work because I had mistakenly put like a backslash as a forward slash or whatnot somewhere, and you had to go back and it took 3 times the amount of time to find the error as it did to write the code, I would be so pissed. I would want to like throw things and break things and throw people. You know, I just couldn't do it. Like that is so not my cup of tea. I'm very impressed by people that can.
There's a whole expression of that. The 90% of the code is the 90% of the work. The last 10% of the code is also 90% of the work.
Well, now correct me if I'm wrong too, but like if from what I remember in most professional situations, everybody else would be kind of like me, where they'd screw something up and then not be able to fix it. And then they're like,
Jim, help. And you had to play cleanup.
That's from people I work with, that's generally not the case, because almost everybody I work with are usually at or above my level of coding knowledge.
Well, nowadays, right? Like now they are, but say like,
oh yeah, back in the day I was the go-to. Yeah, that's how I actually started the career in computers, was in the Army. I was the computer geek, and that was, they would, hey, come fix this. Even though that was not my job. I was not not a signal guy in any way, shape, or form. Mm-hmm. I happen to know computers pretty well.
So tell us about that too. Like, you know, I mean, you're one of those, you're not a big guy like me, but you know, you're a big guy.
Yeah, I am a big guy like you. Thank you very much.
Well, you know, I'm being nice. but you're also, I mean, you're one of those kind of free thinking, very critical thinking, independent thinkers, and you know, more, you know, you have definitely the artistic flair and that kind of stuff. That's not typically the personality type that we associate with folks that go into the service. And it's not that it's a bad thing. I mean, I think critical thinking and you know, creative thinking is something that's needed everywhere, but that wouldn't have necessarily, you know, knowing you as well as I do, you know, it makes sense, but it also is one that it wouldn't seem like that would be kind of like the road that you would choose to go down at first.
Well, you know, I wasn't always the critical thinker either. So, you know, when you're 18, you don't really recognize the political, you know, political minds of people who typically join the military. I was joining the military to join the military to serve. And my intention was actually to be a lifer. I was going to go in and do 20 years. I really, really was. That was going to go in, get my, go in as an enlisted man, get my experience working on helicopters, go to warrant school, and then fly for the next 15 years or whatnot.
It's not a bad plan.
And then I went in and I started doing the job, and it was fun when we were doing the job, but there was just so much downtime, so much, you know, sweeping floors and picking up leaves. Not because they were doing it because, you know, they could do it. It was, there just wasn't that much work to do.
Right.
And this was mid 90s. This was 95 to 2001, pre 9/11. There wasn't much going on. The biggest excursion we had going on there was the Bosnia and Kosovo missions, which I was barely involved in. My unit ended up going right after I left active duty, but they were there for a year and then came back. There's a big long story behind that too. I happened to leave that unit at just the right time.
Sure.
But yeah, that was it. I mean, it was just there wasn't much going on in the world. I mean, this was late Clinton administration. That we were, you know, there was one superpower left. It was us, and nobody really was messing with us at the time.
Peace in the Middle East, or tenuous peace at least, but peace in the Middle East.
Until obviously everything, you know, went to shit.
Well, right. That was unfortunate.
And then at that point, it would have been fun to be, you know, quote unquote fun, not fun as in enjoyable, but quote unquote fun as in, you know, military fun for missions.
You'd be doing your job as opposed to just doing sitting your around. Job.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. But yeah, so while I was there, it's like it just kind of sucked, and it didn't look at that time like anything was going to change anytime in the near future. It was just, you know, this is what it's like being, you know, number one, and nobody can mess with you. Well, we learned that that's not the case, but you know, as a 20-year-old kid, that's what it felt like.
Yeah.
And so I made the decision to go ahead and, all right, we'll get out. We'll go back. We'll do, you know, reserve duties for a while, and, you know, run out my enlistment, and just did not re-up.
Fair enough. Well, what made you decide Army too? I mean, you know, obviously, you know, I have a lot of Air Force people around me, my brother-in-law, my uncle, different people like that. But I also know a lot of Army people. You know, I was in Clarksville. Everybody in the service at some point comes through Campbell. you know, but it's one of those where the branches, I always find it's so interesting, the difference between the different branches and what they do and how they operate. What made you decide to go, you know, Army versus, you know, Navy or Air Force, Marines?
So It was just the job, what was available to me. I had an uncle and who was Air Force. He was a F-16, and then I think he was a B-2 mechanic. He was a crew chief from a fighter jet to a bomber. So big boys.
Right.
And where was he? B-52. I don't remember. It's one of the big bombers. I can't remember which bomber it was now.
I got you.
But anyways, it's been a while since he's been out. I looked at Air Force. I considered it. If I could have gotten into the Academy, I would have gone. Sure. In a heartbeat, I would have gone to Air Force Academy. No question. But it was just a quirk of how the services do their contracts. Mm-hmm. With the Air Force, when you sign your contract, you go and you do your ASVAB test like everybody else.
Yeah.
And they place you on what jobs you can do.
Right.
if I signed up for to be a mechanic for aircraft, great, here's your job, and you get the basic. When you're done with basic and you go to training, it's like, hey, we don't have a slot available for aircraft mechanics, so you're going to be a truck mechanic now. Here you go. And there's nothing you can do about it. It's just, it's part of the contract.
Well, once you sign on the line, that you do what they tell you.
You're in. In the Army, there is wording in it that says, at least it was at the time, I don't know if it's still the case, but in 1984, it was definitely the case. There was a line in your contract. If your job is not available, we'll hold a spot when the next training starts for you, or you can opt out. You can opt out of your military service with no ill will.
That's cool. So,
at which is like, okay. And that I got in, I was an Apache crew chief. I was going to work on Apaches, big gunships, which was like fun. I didn't want to switch to one of the little, to be a truck mechanic or to be a quote unquote computer operator, which can be the cashier at the, the PX or whatever. So that kind of scared me into the Army over Air Force.
Sure. Yeah.
Had I known then what I know now, I would have gone Navy. But on a completely unrelated note, I had a scoutmaster that had after I'd already started talking to the recruiters, and I'd already applied to Air Force Academy and at West Point, but I was not going to get in on my grades. My grades weren't all that great. But one of my scoutmasters one of the assistant scoutmasters had offered to write me a letter of recommendation for Naval Academy. He was a former Marine. But at this point I'm like, I've already got my contract with the Army. I haven't signed anything yet. This is what I'm going to do. So, thanks, but no thanks kind of thing. Right. I appreciate the effort. And then later, I didn't know this at the time, but later I found out he's a Medal of Honor winner. And it's like, it would have been, that was a free pass. I could have got right there.
Man. Oh man. All I can think of is like, God help you if you served on a submarine, in the Navy.
No, I've been on subs. The new nuke subs, I can actually walk around in and not set my head on everything. But the older subs, the diesels, I could not even move around.
Right. Well, and again, for people that don't know what we're talking about, submarines are not made for big folks. They're just not.
I'm not quite Dan size, but I am 6'4". Yeah. And right at the moment, I'm about 350.
So, but I mean, 6'4" puts you what, like 6 inches above where you need to be able to maneuver comfortably in a submarine.
In the old diesels, yes.
Yeah. So, it's just one of those things when you're, space is at a premium in a vehicle like that because you're out for a very long time. So they don't make it, they don't make it for big guys, just because. But so anyway, just like I said, we're sitting here. We know exactly what we're talking about. Not everybody out there does. So no, that makes sense, man. That's cool. That's as good an explanation as any for me going, one route versus another. I could see you being some sort of like, captain on an XO on some sort of big warship or something like that, though, looking out over the water.
I still would have been going for aviation. That would have been at that point, I already had my pilot's license. I mean, it's kind of a no-brainer if you already have, the aptitude for flight. They kind of put you into the flight program.
That was
part of the thing with why I joined the Army over the Air Force. It's like, I wanted to stay at aviation.
Yeah, I gotcha. Yeah, Sam wanted to do, he wanted to fly, but they, at the time, you couldn't be a pilot if you had corrected vision in the Air Force. And, Sam's got them.
That's still pretty much the case. Yeah.
Yeah. So he was very disappointed. And speaking of being a crew chief on bombers, his dad was an F4 crew chief. He was an E8 when he left after 20 years. Yeah. Damn. Which is a man. It's just cool. So where did you get to go? I mean, like all military people got to go somewhere. I mean, unfortunately, sometimes you just go to New Jersey and you're like, ah, crap, it's New Jersey.
That was part of the reason I didn't re-up. It's like I joined the Army to see the world. I got North Carolina, South Carolina, and Virginia. That was my entire enlistment. Basic training in South Carolina, AIT for 7 months in Virginia, and then the rest of my enlistment in North Carolina. And I had asked, send me someplace. Send me to Europe. Send me to North Africa. Send me to Alaska. Send me
somewhere,
I'll volunteer. Look, I'm volunteering for Alaska, goddammit.
Right, exactly.
And it's like, send me anywhere but Korea. I don't want to go to Korea. I would appreciate not being ordered there.
Right.
Just because what I did as an Apache, the only place I could go in Korea would be the DMZ. And the DMZ means the wife can't come with me. And we're newlyweds at that point. And that would have been a full year tour without the wife.
Right.
For 19-year-old kid that's been married for a year, that's not
optimal. No, yeah, I got you. Well, so when did the boys come along there after you guys got married?
Yeah, so we've been married for 5 years when we got pregnant, and 6 years when they were born. So we've been married for, we had gotten to do our kids stuff.
Right. Oh, early, yeah, yeah, for
sure. We got married super early. I mean, we were married. She was 18. I was 19 when we got married.
Yeah. Well, so were you just coming out of your tour then?
No, we got married before. Well, we got married after I was in the Army, but we were engaged before I joined.
Okay. Well, I mean, like for the boys though, like were you out by the time that they came along?
Yeah. I was out when the boys were born.
Okay. Cause you guys, I mean, there was a scare with them when they were first born, if I remember. I mean, so, you know, kind of what happened with that? I mean, cause, and just to throw this out there, medical technology's come a long way in the last 20 years.
So it's, so we got twin boys. They were born in 2002. Just a few months after 9/11. At that point, I had been out. I got out my IETS from the Army. My official release date was 3 weeks before 9/11. So at that point, I'm stressing, am I getting called back?
Right. Yeah. Because you're on inactive reserve for a couple of years, right?
Yeah. I was on inactive reserve until 2003. But yeah. So we're sitting there in that phase. We don't know what's going on. And then the boys were born. 2001 was an absolute shitty year. It started off pretty good, but it ended up being pretty shitty. I worked for a company called Nortel Networks, which was there in Raleigh. We did telecommunications in general, all sorts of stuff. But telco was going through a little bit of a revolution about that time, and it wasn't working well for Nortel. And so that particular year, we decided, you know, hey, we've been doing this for a few years. I'm making good money. She's making pretty good money. We're stable. We're at a point where, hey, we could start a family if we wanted to.
Right.
And both of us are our parents' oldest, so it'd be the first grandkids and all that sort of stuff. And we made the decision to go ahead and let's start trying. And so June comes along and she gets a plus on her test. And so we find out we're expecting. July 1st, about a week later, we get notifications that, hey, just FYI, our stock is not going to make, we're not going to make our earnings by a little bit. And so our stock's going to go down a little bit. So be on the lookout. And a couple weeks later, it was, by the way, we're going to have layoffs.
Yeah.
All right. And so a week later, we go to the doctors and, hey, by the way, you're having twins. Cool. And then the next week, by the way, you're getting laid off.
Right.
So within a span of 3 months there, we went from, you know, being completely stable and ready to have kids to being blindsided. And then, so I got laid off, which I got a decent severance package. And so I started looking for more work. This is August at this point. And my severance runs out in October. And of course, 9/11 happens. And then the economy just absolutely went to shit. So there were no jobs. There was nobody hiring. Nobody was wanting to do anything for a while there, so I was unemployed. Come the next month, say November, I guess, Christine's put on bed rest because she's having twins.
Right. And
he's 5'2" and a
105
pounds soaking wet beforehand.
She doesn't have the same frame you do for carrying children.
And they're my kids too, so they're gonna be gigantic.
Right, exactly.
But she gets put on bed rest, and so she's on disability pays for a while. So she's at 60%. I'm at zero. So we're, you know, we move out of our house where we're renting. We moved into her mom for a little bit. I moved back to Indiana to work at the shop for a few months to make some money. Met with my dad's store back home. And she stayed in North Carolina while I was working. And so she was there at her mom's house on bed rest from November until the middle of January when the boys were born. And when they were born, they come out about 5 pounds, 5 pounds, 4 ounces, pretty good, healthy size kids.
For
their 6 weeks early. At that point they were 6 weeks.
Right. Yeah.
But you know, pretty good size for babies that if they would have gone to term, that would not have been good for her.
No,
but being born early ended up being a blessing because both of them had a heart condition. It's pulmonary stenosis. So it was the pulmonary valve in their heart is not quite formed. It's slightly webbed, which produces a significant murmur. But with one of them, it was bad enough that he needed surgery right then. If he had been born to term, he might not have survived because there's a bypass vein in the heart while it's forming that bypasses that valve. I would guess to not interfere with the mother's heartbeat so they're not beating against each other or whatever.
Sure.
But there's a kind of a bypass valve for that that's still open when they're very young, and it kind of falls off. It becomes, a non-functioning vein anymore as they approach their term date. But because they were early, that vein was still open, so it was still allowing enough pumping to go through. But his heart's only, even with that extra veins, he's only getting like 70% of blood flow or something like that. Whereas his O2 levels were significant. Right. And so literally the day he's born, they scheduled his heart surgery for us, which would be, he was fine for a few days. So they did it for the next Tuesday because Monday was a holiday. Mm-hmm. This is mid-January. So Martin Luther King's day was a Monday. So they scheduled for Tuesday morning. So he's 3 days old at that point. And had we been born anywhere else, literally in the world, it would have been open heart surgery. Mm-hmm. But where we were in a hospital that was part of Duke University. So Duke University Medical Center was there, and they had a doctor on staff who had just gotten FDA approval for valvuloplasty surgery on infants that goes through through an artery. So they go up through the leg with one of the balloons,
right,
and the cameras, and navigate through. So he went in through his thigh, up into his chest, into his heart, and literally cut the webbing on this misformed valve when he's on a 3-day premature baby. And so, yeah,
so that was
kind of the end of the, well, not really the end. It was the beginning of the end for the troubles of the 2001 era. But yeah, the other one has the heart murmur. He's got the pulmonary stenosis, but it was nowhere near as severe as his brother. And so he didn't need the surgery, and they told him he would just kind of grow out of that. And for the most part, he has, and his brother's actually done fine. He hasn't needed any surgeries since. They tell us that there's a good chance he'll need that valve replaced at some point.
Sure.
But at the moment, he's fine. They said that it could be as early as, when he turns 20, he'll need it, but nobody's pushing for that yet.
Sure.
But yeah, so he has a standing heart condition. His brother has it as well, which automatically disqualified both of them for military service,
unfortunately. Right.
But then, yeah, a few months later, his brother got sick. He got some sort of ulcerative colitis, and it was idiopathic. They never found out what caused it, but he ended up spending almost 3 months between the other hospitals in Raleigh. And we ended up at University of North Carolina Medical Center for him and spent a month out there. And then as he got better, we, were finally able to go home. I got a new job at Sprint in Wake Forest at the time. And we moved into a very small house in Wake Forest, North Carolina for a few months. Well, it ended up being almost 2 years. But yeah, that was kind of the beginning of the end. And so from there, I was looking up for a while. It took a very long time to get back to close to what, where we were financially. It was just a really bad time to take a hit. But
And you took a few in succession.
Oh yeah, it was rapid fire. I mean, that was,
Well, you
that
know,
was a semi-automatic shotgun with 7 shells
in it. Yeah, joke. Jeez, that's buckshot too. That's not birdshot. That's just straight to the, That's right about the time Dick Cheney shot somebody in the face. No, because it was a little earlier. Yeah. No, yeah. I'm just,
It was a little before, but yeah.
Speaking of shotguns, yeah. so when people think of surgery nowadays, a lot of times people do just think of laparoscopic surgery where you're able to go in through.
There's so much they can do.
Right, exactly. But I mean, we're talking about, when you're saying like open heart surgery, I mean, you're talking about literally cracking the chest open, cracking the rib cage open and having to go at it, just attacking it from outside. And, it's insane to think that like, I mean, it that was the time where we knew a lot compared to say 10 years before, but compared to now, with the computer, the way technology is advanced. I mean, it's like the dark ages almost.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
And, I mean, that's no small miracle that literally the one person in the world that could do that, because that was like on the very, the very front edge of, the medical frontier, that's just, I mean, that's.
Yeah, it was absolutely lucky. We are very much in the lucky category there.
Yeah. Well, so for anybody listening too, when you hear like Duke, UNC, for the vast majority of the country and the states, at least, I know you just are thinking like basketball, right? Like they're just schools that have basketball teams. But what people that have never lived in that area don't realize is that the schools themselves, as well as, and especially the medical programs and the university hospitals at Duke and UNC are both world-class facilities, and that rival any kind of, like Ivy League, which is also another athletic league, not actually like an academic standard thing, but
it's up there with John Hopkins,
right? Mayo exactly, and, right. I mean, there are
Duke and UNC are kind of competing back and forth,
right? Exactly. So, Center. Yeah, so we're talking like and on the world scale, I mean, we're talking right up there with Mayo Clinic and, you know, places like, I mean, just top notch. So that is at least one fortunate thing of being there.
But that's funny. I think back, if you ever watched The Good Place?
Yes, I like that show. Yeah,
Tahani's character, that was one of her things, was Duke University is the minimal acceptable degree,
right?
For somebody she's willing to date. Duke University is the minimal.
Right. Oh my gosh. Yeah, I'd forgotten that. Oh man, that's awesome. Yeah, see, no, that's good though. And you know, the one difference between the two is UNC is a public, you know, state school, and Duke is a private school. Yep. The tuition's probably what you figure if you're going to college, they're probably what, 50 times the other?
It's not quite that much. It's probably three, four times.
Well, it's a
from one to the other. It's a lot though. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, it's a significant difference. Yeah. So that's the big difference there. So more credit goes out there, in my opinion, to UNC for doing that as a public school versus a private one, lower budgets and whatnot.
Yeah.
Now that's cool, man. So you bounced around different, you bounced around to different places, doing IT, you know, doing coding and that kind of stuff, which is of course very cool. You know, that seems to me that was the first of the modern kind of career paths that kind of led to like the gig economy type thing that we see, because, you know, before that, it seemed like people would stay at their jobs forever, you know, and just retire as whatever they are. And in IT, it was the first time where people, a broader range of people, it seemed like, was able to be like, look, I have these skills and I have, you know, $20,000 a year, more skills than I had 2 years ago when you hired me. So
it's not so much the IT that's okay. So full disclosure there, I do software engineering now. It's my second career. My first career was obviously I was a mechanic. But when I went to school, so I started off at Purdue University. I was going to do aerospace engineering. It was tacking on to my aviation work that I did in the Army. And again, this, you know, hindsight being 2020, it's different. I switched my major from aerospace engineering to political science. And then my plan at that point, I got a job. That was why I left the school. I got a job at Nortel, paying really good money for a 23-year-old kid. It's like, you know, I'm in school, paying $20,000 a year for school back in the 90s, not today, obviously. And you know, you get a job as a 21-year-old saying, hey, we'll give you $50,000 a year.
Right.
Cool. I quit school. Moved to North Carolina, started working. That was a no-brainer. That was as much money as I could have possibly made at the time. Mm-hmm. But I switched my major to political. I went back to school at NC State when Nortel obviously folded and stock market tanked in 2001 happened. In 2002, I went back to school and switched to political science and minored in computer programming because I still was good at computers. It was something that I could do that could pay the bills. But the political science part of that is where I was going with that part of the conversation. I intended to become a lawyer and do IP telephony law, and I might still go that route in the future, but right now I make good money, so I'm happy where I'm at. But you talked about the gig economy, and I think that plays more into not so much the tech industry allowing for it, but the, you know, the socioeconomic strata that we were in at the time, mm-hmm. and the political will to do things had changed considerably to where, you know, enterprises, businesses, you know, corporations started being able to manipulate the rules a little bit differently.
Sure.
This is when the rise of the 401k come into play, as pensions, unions started getting busted. There was all these things that led to that gig economy, not just tech enabled it. If tech didn't enable it, we would still be doing all sorts of gig shit, but it wouldn't be the same. It would just be more
slavery. Yeah, yeah.
And the loss of pensions, yeah.
If nothing else, I'm going to have to make a t-shirt out of that. That was great. Yeah.
But the computers, the internet in general, did allow for that. So now it gives us that option. It's like, you know what? You guys have stopped giving us pensions. You're not being loyal to us as employees.
Right.
There's no point in us as employees being loyal to our employers anymore, which is why, you know, 20 years ago, even 10 years ago, people, I sat in interviews where people would, you know, do resumes or look at resumes and go, they've job hopped. They go to a new job every year. We don't want this person working for us because they're going to leave
us. Right.
And you know, now that means nothing.
Nope.
It means absolutely nothing. It's like, oh, okay. Well, you've got 10 jobs in the last 10 years. Why is that? Contract ended, contract ended, contract ended, contract ended, contract ended. got fired for drinking on the job, contract ended. but yeah, it's just nobody bats an eye twice about us. You put that far enough down in the resume, they don't notice.
Agreed. Yeah, that's true. Just put it on the back of the first page. It's, you know, most people won't even flip it. Yeah. That's awesome. You're like, yeah,
I was legal, and it was at a brewery. And oh my, oh, that's so good. That's, see, that's just now, I feel compelled to mention, folks, too, that that Nortel Systems, who he's talking about, that he worked for, there are companies like Nortel, and somewhat to an extent like Ericsson was in the 80s and 90s, that were behind the scenes in the wireless mobile communication industry that you didn't necessarily ever see their name. Ericsson made a few handsets, so phones, so every once in a while you might see them. But Nortel, if you had a cell phone between, what, 1985 to 2001, 2002, really when all that started to hit, and you traveled at all, more than likely the signal that carried your call was on a Nortel radio.
All your physical phone, your handsets, your, landlines, every single one of those went through a Nortel PBX, almost exclusively. Mm-hmm. I mean, anywhere in the country.
Right. So when Jim says that he was recruited out of college to go to Nortel, this is the equivalent of being recruited out of college today to go to Google or something like NASA
back in the day. Yeah.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. I mean, because I mean, those guys, if you wanted to communicate at that time, you know, you had to go through their tech. So they were the top echelon of top echelon, you know, companies in that world. So
not to downplay my contributions in any way, shape, or form. At the time, this was also, this was 1999, 2000.
Sure.
And, you know, at this era, this is the desktop revolution. This is, Linux has been out for like 5 years at this point. Nobody's heard of it, but it's quietly replacing all of the mainframe systems are in the back end, where Unix is running, Solaris is running on all the big services. So people who know how desktop operating systems work, now some of that work is applied to servers and is applied to enterprise level systems. And we're kind of getting away from mainframe stuff. The problem with that is there is literally no education. You could not graduate from college with a degree in Linux. You could not graduate from college with a degree in, you know, Unix operating systems, all these things that just rapidly took off. It's kind of like in the Space Administration when they were you know, doing NASA and doing the moon missions and Gemini programs and Mercury programs. You know, there was no such thing as a degree in aerospace engineering.
Right.
So you're recruiting people from different fields, trying to cobble together the best minds you can for it. Well, in 2000, 2001, it's the same thing. Companies are looking wherever they can find, you know, people who know computers and know tech and know coding, even through non-traditional means. So you're not looking necessarily at the colleges, even though obviously you were, but you were also looking at people who worked at call centers, people that would, you know, contact you from email, from a personal email server, because they could run one.
Right.
You know, you know computers? There were several ads back in the day. I'm trying to think of the one in particular I was doing. It was a stupid ad, but it was so on point. And it was somebody going into a venture capitalist and looking for money, and it's the most inept thing ever. Well, yeah, I guess we kind of can do that. We can do this, and maybe we could do that, and maybe make some money, and, you know, but, you know, it just depends on how big we can make it on the internet. And everybody's just bored out of their mind until the guy says internet, and all of a sudden all the VC, this is the internet, you can do it, you can do this, here's money. It was kind of the same thing. If you knew anything about computers, companies everywhere were like, yes, we'll hire you. So it was a good time to be. It was, again, a lucky break. I was in the right place at the right time, and have played everything in my career basically on that, you know, on that one play. So,
well, it was a good one though, man. I mean, it worked out. You know, that's like what is the guy's name? The little Doug Flutie is like his big pass at Boston College, man. Like, you only need one of them, you know?
That's right.
You only need one of them. If you don't know what I'm talking about, young people and old people, like, go on YouTube, search Doug Flutie. It was Boston College.
Hail Mary. Yeah. Yeah. The Hail Mary that's made his entire NFL career.
Correct.
Which proved that his NFL career was a fluke, because he was famous for one play.
Right. Yeah, for real.
Which is why he didn't do all that well.
The CFL too. Yeah. He played in Canada as well. But like I said, you only have to have one. But yeah, that secured some income for many years for him.
Somewhere or another, I have a Doug Flutie action figure, one of those back in the day when they had the and it wasn't one I bought, it was somebody had given it to me, or it's like, I don't like the Patriots. Hell.
I will admitting to liking Drew Bledsoe much more once he left the Patriots. I will say that.
I don't like Tom Brady anymore after he's left. I just don't.
He definitely has an attitude about him, but I will give him credit for winning
in Tampa Bay, which is a very difficult thing to do.
In fairness, if he wasn't a dying-the-wool Trumpkin, I probably would like him more. That just seals the deal. It's like, nope, you will never have respect.
Well, so, okay. So now throwing that out there, I am curious about what your take is. I mean, obviously the country has been more and more and more and more polarized. You know, 9/11 was it felt like to me, it was a tipping point where everybody was on the same page, but there were lots of different things that were being put into place that would then serve to divide people later on, you know, different decisions that were made in the years after. And now we've got this radical thing. And so we've had this pandemic, which sucks, you know, where everybody has had to, well, now granted for us semi-antisocial people, it's nice to be able to curl up in a ball and work at home occasionally. But it's still, you know, we've got this divide, and you've got all these people. You know, Aaron Rodgers, for example, is just, they're talking about where, you know, he said he was immunized, but didn't actually have like the COVID vaccine. And, you know, I know a lot of very intelligent, right-leaning individuals who have had the vaccine, you know, but I also know, like, what's funny is I know there are a lot of some semi-intelligent left-leaning people who haven't, like, it's like, so it's not exactly how we see it, but as someone who has lived in and is from relatively conservative area, but who's also been, say, like to the weird capital of the world in Portland for a while and different things like that, and somebody who is what I would call a reasonable leftist, in my opinion, you know, what do you think about all of that in the world right now?
All right. So I don't consider myself a leftist at all, for the record.
Well, a social leftist, I would think.
Yeah, right? Yeah. I get what you're saying. I just want to make sure, point that out there. I'm not a leftist. Don't call me a leftist.
Well, I use the word reasonable.
I am a progressive. I'll own that. I'm a liberal. I'll own that. But because, and we've had this conversation too before.
I know, yeah.
I grew up in Indiana. I'm from here. I'm from 50 miles north of Indianapolis. Mm-hmm. Cornfields. And back in the day, it was cornfields and factories. Well, now the factories are gone. We had three main employers in my hometown: Continental Steel, GM, Delco, which then became Delphi Delco, mm-hmm. and Chrysler. We had a Chrysler transmission plant, and that was it. If you didn't work for one of those three companies, you worked for a company that was directly supporting one of those three companies. That was, I mean, those three companies were literally the entire economy.
Right, that's small town America at the time.
Well, we weren't really small town. We were small city.
Were
50,000 people ish.
Yeah, which I gotcha.
It's 50,000 people, but everybody knows everybody and everybody knows everybody's shit. So,
well, at least you do have a cool name, you know, as far as the town goes.
That's after a Beach Boys song now. So it's like, it doesn't make it cool. That makes it boomer.
Okay, fair enough. Continue. I apologize.
But anyways, yeah. So I grew up in a town where it's cornfields as far as the eye can see. It is Trump country. It absolutely is.
Yeah.
And not for rational reasons. It is. Trump's white and panders to white people, and that.
Well, he's orange, but I hear what you mean.
That's fair. That's fair. Trump presents himself as white. How's that? He identifies as white, even though he is orange. He is an Oompa Loompa. Oh my God. An outsized Oompa Loompa who identifies as white. But at any rate, so it is a conservative area. People do have conservative values. But because of those factories, because of GM, because of Continental Steel, because of Chrysler and some of the smaller plants, like the potteries that were there. We had a Gerber and an American Standard there at one point. It's a union town, or at least it used to be a union town. And so, you know, Democratic policies were, you know, tempered with conservative ideals, but people looked at both sides of it. And you know, we were absolutely a swing district. We would have, you know, a Republican congressman, then a Democratic congressman, then a Republican congressman. It bounced back and forth. It was just whoever the better candidate was for the people. And and while I am a Democrat, I am a liberal and progressive and all that sort of stuff. I'm a moderate radical, I guess, is the best way to describe it. I want good progressive policies. I want health care for all. I want single payer health care. I want universal health care. I want universal schools. I want free college tuition. I want, you know, jobs programs for anybody that wants to work. I want all these policies that help people do things. But I understand when people come back and scream that, you know, this is too expensive, or that's too expensive, or that's, you know, this goes against my Christian values.
Right.
I understand that you're wrong, but I understand where you're coming from, you know, but, you know, And but that's how that plays in why I am the way I am and why I fall, you know, my decisions tend to be moderate. If prime example was the 2016 presidential primaries, mm-hmm. It boiled down to Hillary and Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders is definitely the progressive dream. He is everything that a true socialist would, or true democratic socialist would want to be. Mm-hmm. I really, really, really hate that the term socialism has become this, you know, boogeyman, you know, buzzword for bad and evil when it's not. Socialism is what we already have and already are living in, mm-hmm. and people refuse to acknowledge that. A democratic socialist is not a communist. God damn it, it's not the same thing. But anyways, that's getting off into a tangent. But anyways, Bernie was the progressive. Love, I agree with 98% of everything that comes out of Bernie Sanders' mouth.
Fair enough.
I think he's smart. He knows what he's talking about. He's right on most of the issues. But the problem is there's so many people on the other side that absolutely vehemently disagree with anything that comes out of his mouth. Some for valid reasons, some because they don't know any better and they've just been told by their friends, pastors, brothers, wife's nephew that, you know, Bernie Sanders eats babies at pizza parlors or whatever. And there's no convincing those people that, you know, that conspiracy theory is stupid, but it is what it is. Mm-hmm. But Bernie, as the progressive, he's the one I agree with way more than Hillary. But I think Hillary was a better candidate. I still think Hillary is the most qualified person to ever run for the office of the presidency.
I would agree with that as way well.
More. Yeah, she's smart. She knows what she's doing. Everything she did, while you may not like how she did things, stuff like the email servers. Mm-hmm. I run email servers. I have run hundreds of email servers. I know how this stuff works. And I trust my security over a government agent security. Every single time, unless you're talking NSA, CIA, sure. FBI, those guys, yeah, they can afford good cryptology. They can afford good InfoSec. They can afford to make their stuff super, super secure. But the Department of Interior, I don't trust their mail servers more than anybody else. I completely understood from a professional perspective, mm-hmm. why she would want her own email service, ones that she can manage. She can pay her own security team right. to do. Plus the fact that the previous Secretary of State did that and told them, this is how we did it. This is why we did it. Mm-hmm. Colin Powell, who was a Republican, did that.
Oh,
Susan
yeah.
Rice, Republican, did that. Or Condoleezza Rice, not Susan Rice. Sorry. Condi Rice. Yeah, they all ran their own servers.
Right.
But, you know, all those that things that went into it all of a sudden became a conspiracy when Hillary does it. And it's like, anyways.
I gotcha.
I'll go on tangents. But Hillary was the moderate choice. She was absolutely, agreed. she is a capitalist Democrat. She is not mm-hmm. a socialist Democrat. She is all about that money. But she, the main difference between Hillary and Bernie at the time was Bernie really, really, truly cares about the issues, really, truly cares about the policies, and really, truly cares mm-hmm. about getting the policies in place right. to solve what he thinks are the biggest problems. You may disagree on whether they are actually problems. You may disagree whether mm-hmm. where they rank in the list of problems that we have. You may disagree with that the funding is necessary for different programs or whatever, all that extra stuff. But you have to acknowledge Bernie Sanders really, truly does care about medical care for all, or, you know, free college tuition for students and all that stuff. He does not care if he does it, or if AOC does it, or if
right.
some person born two generations after he's dead does it. He doesn't mm-hmm. care who does it. He doesn't care if he gets the credit for it. He wants those policies in place.
Right.
Hillary, on the other hand, couldn't care less about the policies. She does not live, work, and breathe healthcare, live, work, and breathe college tuition, live, work, right. and breathe Medicare and you know, financial insecurities and
right.
you know, doesn't care. Her thing is, she wants a legacy. She at the time, you know, she wanted sure, to be yeah. president. So her name gets etched in the list of people who have been president of the greatest nation on earth. That was her thing. That's what she wanted mm-hmm. to do. You know, and in her head, did you ever read Beowulf in high school?
It's been a hot minute. A hot yes, minute. I have. Yeah.
That was when I remember studying that. And one of the things they talked about, this was the whole, you know, the whole Norse mythology was the only way you live forever is in legend. You don't right. necessarily go to heaven and live forever. No,
right.
You,
right.
If your name is known, fame is the biggest thing. You have to do deeds great enough that people remember you for generations. That was the whole point of Beowulf. Mm-hmm. And Hillary was that way. She kind of lives that life too. It's like, yeah, the only way I get to be, I don't want to be remembered as the person who got me president. I want to be the person who was a great president,
right,
that fixed all our problems. And, you know, 100 years from now, people are talking about me in the same voice as FDR or Lincoln, mm-hmm, or Washington. That's what she really wants more than anything else. And quite frankly, it's not a bad goal. But, you know, she kind of misjudged how much people on the right absolutely hate her for how much she's been demonized for the last 30 years. She has. And you know where things went.
Oh, yeah.
But as candidates between Bernie and Hillary, I disagree with Hillary on, you know, 30% of what she wants to do. I would rather have the progressive policy. But I also know that, you know, on the far right, they're going to be bashing the hell out of everything Bernie's got. And then the mid-right is going to be agreeing with the people on the far right. And then the independents are just, it's a toss-up. Do we do the stuff that, you know, half the country says is crazy, evil bullshit? Or do we do the stuff over here with this guy? It's new. It sounds stupid, but at least it's not evil. And that was the whole decision of Trump versus Bernie versus versus Hillary. It was, we think Hillary's evil. And so we're going to vote for Trump because he's not Hillary. And that was what won the election. It wasn't the 20% of the people that were voting for Trump that were diehard Trump supporters that are, for lack of a better term, morons. That wasn't the winning. It was the independents and the people in the middle that were leaning and just, I don't like Trump, but at least he's not evil like Hillary.
Right.
And so that's how he won.
You know, there were some things, and I mean, you know me better than most people do, man, but I always try to find whatever good I can in situations, and I try to give credit where credit's due. And as far as everything that Trump did when he was in office, most things I definitely will agree. I was not a fan of. There are a couple of things that I will say that I thought he at least tried to do well. He tried to come at the, you know, there was a point where he tried to come at immigration from a perspective of, let's get down and make a deal, let's negotiate, where he was going to extend the DACA protections in exchange for money to add on to build more of his wall, that kind of thing. Which, like, there, and also there were some things, there were some decisions that his administration made when it came to small businesses, some things that helped small businesses as far as writing off, you know, purchases for capital purchases, equipment, vehicles, that kind of stuff. Which, because I'm in the small business world all the time, I see the difference that makes. There were some things that I feel like he did well. So I try to give the credit there. Again, I'm not saying I'm a fan of the guy. People that listen know that I'm very much a social, you know, liberal, somewhat financially conservative, but social liberal for sure. And there were a lot of things that I disagreed with. But like I said, at least I do at least try to give credit where credit's due. And as well as, you know, I will say this too, I know that there are some people that I agree fall into that category on both sides, the left and the right, they hear the propaganda and they go for it. And like, there was a woman that worked for me a few years ago during the 2016 election, who was very smart, sweet, kind lady who normally was very intuitive and understanding. But when something came out of somebody's mouth, you know, on the right, she believed what they said. And so, you know, when talking about it, she said, like, well, I just can't vote for somebody who, you know, whose emails got all those people in Benghazi killed. And I'm like, these are separate issues. Like, and this was like a perfectly rational, normal, reasonable human being, you know. And I do know some people who are like, you know, I'm worried about the economy, I'm worried about where my paychecks go, all this other kind of stuff, who are, yeah, I mean, who are reasonable in the reasons they support somebody like that. And I'll be the first one to say, like, I thought Bill Clinton was one of the best presidents we ever had. Do I think he's necessarily a stand-up guy? Not really, you know, but it's the whole thing of our, you know, like, do we want politicians to be politicians and get shit done, or do we want to have role models, you know? And so I understand where a lot of those people are coming from, because they, especially the ones that didn't like Obama, they felt threatened by Obama. You can understand why they felt that way. I don't agree with them, but at least you can kind of see, we have, in my opinion, you always have to see the other side in order to be able to understand better where you sit. You know what I mean?
There's an old line in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy that says, no man who is capable of getting himself elected president should be allowed to do the job. and I understand the sentiment. Generally kind of agree with it, but I get it. Good people don't make good presidents, though.
Right.
That's been shown over and over again. Jimmy Carter is honest to God, the best person to ever serve in the White House. Mm-hmm. Hands down, he was and is a good human being. Just to the core, he's a good person.
I mean, he's in his mid-90s now, and he's still out building habitat houses and all that kind of stuff. I mean,
And not, you know, getting rich off of his presidency.
Right.
But And honest to goodness, you know, honest to goodness, his presidency, the him being remembered as not being a good president is almost entirely outside influence. I mean, he got hit with the oil embargo, with stagflation that was associated with that. He lost his election because of the Iran-Contra situation, which had nothing to do with him. I still, you had, you know, earlier we talked about conspiracy theories that and here's a good honest one that I think is accurate, is that Reagan was a traitor.
To be continued. Thank you for listening to The Power of Weird. This episode was brought to you by the Rosemary Run novel series, published by Standards of Starlight Books. Follow the women of Rosemary Run, California, as they face the darkness hiding beneath their community's picturesque facade. Find more about the Rosemary Run series, as well as other Standards of Starlight novels, at standardsofstarlight.com or by following the link in the description below. Make sure to stay tuned for more of my story, as well as great interviews with amazing weird people. And remember, be the weird you want to see in the world. We'll see you next time on The Power of Weird.